17. Happy St. Patty's Day. The Senate Tax Committee is in order. Members, before we start, I do want to ask Senator Weber to take a look at a few bills in the Property Tax Subcommittee. And those bills are Senate Files 3945, 3980, 4001, and Files 3576, 3200, and 3451. So, Senator Weber, if you can take a look at those in the subcommittee, that'd be great. Those are all related to property taxes. Today, members, we have, four bills. The intention is that each of them will be laid over. And our first bill is Senator Pratt's bill. Senator Pratt, Senate File 3642, welcome to the committee. Senator Coleman, could you move Senate File 3642, please?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Coleman. Well, Senator Pratt, welcome to the Tax Committee. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, under federal law, nuclear power plant owners are required to pay for dismantling plants and safely disposing of the fuels when the useful life of the plant has expired. In order to provide that financial viability, plant owners are required to set aside funds into a trust, which will eventually be used to decommission these nuclear power plants. Senate File 3642 adds a nuclear decommissioning reserve fund to the list of entities exempt from Minnesota income tax. The requirement to pay income tax on these funds reduces the amount available for the intended purpose, requiring ratepayers to contribute more and increase the cost of electricity. Madam Chair and members, this bill is extremely timely as our current nuclear power plants were commissioned in the early 70s and are quickly getting to the end of their useful life. And with that, it's a fairly technical bill, so I'll let my testifiers get into the weeds on it.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. I don't have the list of testifiers. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Jim Pearson with Xcel Energy, and I'm here this morning to provide a little bit of overview of how this works from our perspective and to answer questions. So as Senator Pratt indicated, there is a connection between money we collect from our customers and the trust fund. And so this bill is really about how the trust fund is taxed. So there's two legal entities. There's obviously Xcel Energy, where I'm an employee, and then there's the trust, which is a separate legal entity in the state of Pennsylvania. So currently, So through our rate-making process that's regulated through the Public Utilities Commission, we are responsible for making sure that the Nuclear Decommissioning Trust Fund is adequately funded. And so we collect money through rates, and that is the money that is sent to the trust and held in Pennsylvania. So the state of Minnesota currently taxes the earnings on that fund on an annual basis. And obviously, as Senator Pratt alluded to, that tax bill then impacts the amount in the trust. And so this is an ongoing process. And so as we look to set rates, we have to again make sure that the fund is adequately funded. And so that is part of our calculation that we put into the input process as we go before the Public Utilities Commission. So for example, we filed a rate case in November, and as part of that case, we have costs associated with making sure the trust fund is adequately funded on a go-forward basis. And part of this conversation is that we can only collect through our customer rates the amount of needed for the trust fund while the plants are operating. So currently, those operating licenses expire in the 2030s. However, the decommissioning fund will obviously far outlive the operation of the plants. So we need to make sure that tax liabilities in that post-operation period, which would be 30 to 50 years, are also collected through rates. And so what that leads to is that we're making sure that we're collecting rates in the short term to ensure that the tax liability on a go-forward basis is accounted for. So that is why there is a connection in terms of what our customers pay to make sure it's adequately funded. I want to be clear that when the time comes and we look to decommission the facilities, that money then does flow to Xcel Energy and, of course, would be taxed under applicable law. So we view Senator Pratt's bill as something that is needed and helpful to our customers, obviously support it, and would be happy to dive into any pieces of what I've talked about in more detail if the committee has questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. So it's my understanding, I think you've underlined it, that this gets passed on to the ratepayer in some way. And so my question is, what do other states do? But to me, it seems to make sense that with rates sky high, going sky high right now, we try to find ways to keep it down. But I'm curious what other states do.
Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair and Senator Gazelka, I may have to look into that a little bit closer. It's my understanding from talking to our tax group that this is a unique situation in terms of the annual tax on the fund's earnings. So I'm not aware of that happening in other states, although I would want to double check to ensure that I'm correct on that. That is my understanding, however, from talking to our tax group.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Senator Gazelka, I think that's a good question. I was wondering that as well. And just to maybe get a little bit further sense of this, and if you've already said this, please just repeat it again. But do you have an idea how this would impact the ratepayers? What would they see? What kind of a rate reduction or non-increase would you expect on, I don't know how you measure that, the average ratepayer or per dollar, per $100? I'm just not sure. What's your metric for that, for measuring the impact on ratepayers, and what might that be?
Madam Chair, members, that's a great question. And it's part of the overall rate making process. And so just to give you a sense on our current filing, so our current case, we are building in, well, we project around a $20 million savings in terms of the cost inputs that we would bring into the case if this bill passes. And so what we do is, obviously, as I mentioned, we need to collect this money and make sure a future tax liability is accounted for from now until the operating license, which, in using Prairie Island as an example, those are operating licenses in 2033 and 34. And so from now until 2033 and 34, we need to make sure that all of that money is collected, even though the trust fund will far outlive those dates. And so in our current case, when you put in the inputs and figure out what the growth on the fund and all of those things, so we would, if the bill passes, we would go back and revise our assumption on this particular detail of the case and lower it by roughly $20 million. And so, again, I can't say that the commission will ultimately approve that and that, transfers to a residential customer in this way. However, we work off of those assumptions, and as we work through the case with the commission, we would be making a revised filing based on the progress of this bill. I hope that helps. I know it doesn't necessarily translate to $5 per customer or something, but it is an important input to the overall rate case, which obviously, as you take costs out of that, that helps customers.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. We know that all of Minnesotans are struggling, still struggling, really, from even last year's skyrocketing energy rates, and then with the really almost historic inflation as well. So it's important, I think, that we look out for taking these costs out of the equation when possible. So just to reiterate, I think what you said is it would impact about $20 million of lower costs as you determine rates, and you'll be taking that before the PUC then.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Again, this is one of many inputs that we put into the rate case. And obviously in Minnesota, it's a cost-based system, and so we go before the commission and lay out in very granular detail what our costs are. There are many things that go into that. This is one of them. So to the extent that we can lower that, that will benefit the overall rate case.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Pearson. Any further comments or questions, members? I don't see any online either. So Senator Pratt, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Mr. Pearson laid it out very well. When we start to decommission these plants, the state has a very direct stake in making sure that we have the resources available to do it safely and affordably and not pass that on to the taxpayers in general. This will allow this fund, this bill will allow the fund to continue to be financially viable and recognize how important it is for us to decommission these plants, because as Mr. Pearson said, these dates are starting to creep up very, very quickly. If you don't think, it sounds like 10, 15 years might be a long way off. It'll be on us before we know it.
I thank you, Senator Pratt. Senator Colvin renews the motion at 3642. It'll be later. Thank you, Senator Pratt.
Thank you.
Next up is Senator Claussen with Senate File 3563, Temporary Refundable Preceptor Income Tax Credit. And Senator Weber, would you like to move Senate File 3563?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Weber. Senator Claussen, welcome to the Tax Committee. To your bill.
Thank
do you have any amendments, Senator Claussen?
I do not, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. To your bill.
Thank you. Well, good morning, Madam Chair, committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to introduce Senate File 3563. It's a proposal to provide a pilot preceptor tax credit program. Well, the healthcare industry is the largest employer in Minnesota, and anticipated growth is outpacing national trends. However, Minnesota is also facing a severe healthcare workforce shortage. One issue to be addressed is the shortage of medical resident, advanced practice nurse, physician assistant, and mental health preceptors. The lack of preceptor positions has led to a bottleneck in the Minnesota healthcare workforce pipeline, where students who have completed their coursework are waiting for a preceptor assignment, which could take, in some cases, months. A preceptor is responsible for the on-site supervision, training, assessment, and evaluation of a student while also serving as a role model during the residency period. The scope of preceptor responsibilities takes away time from individual patients and duties resulting in the loss of income. The intent of Senate File 3563 is to provide a preceptor financial incentive to make up for the lost patient time and income. Section 1, Subdivision 1 of the bill defines preceptor eligibility and allows a tax credit equal to $5,000. Preceptors are eligible for the tax credit if they serve at least 12 weeks or 480 hours and receive no compensation. Subdivision 2 is the appropriation. Subdivision 3 contains reporting requirements, including the number of preceptors claiming the credit, average amount claimed, the geographic distribution of preceptor services, and the impact of the credit on the availability of preceptors in Minnesota. And Madam Chair, with that, we do have two testifiers this morning to the bill.
Thank you, Senator Claussen. Dr. Emily Onello, Minnesota Medical Association and the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Emily Onello, and I am a family physician practicing in Duluth, Minnesota, and I'm also serving as a full-time assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Biobehavioral Health on the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota Medical School. I serve as the course director for both the Rural Medical Scholars Program and the Family Medicine Preceptorship Course, two programs that place first and second year medical students across our state to be trained by preceptors. Today, I am testifying on behalf of both the Minnesota Medical Association as well as the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians in support of Senate File 3563. According to data from the Association of the American Medical Colleges, the United States could see an estimated shortage of between 37,800 and 124,000 physicians by 2034, including shortfalls in both primary care and specialty care. In Minnesota, we are projectedly facing a shortage of nearly 1,200 primary care physicians by the year 2030. A critical part of our training of our new physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and others is providing them these clinical training sites throughout their education. That clinical training takes place in hospitals and clinics throughout the state and is dependent on local physicians and other members of the healthcare team to serve as preceptors for students and residents. Senate File 3563 is one tool to help us recruit the needed physicians to serve as preceptors. Since 2015, the Minnesota Medical Association has been working with the University of Minnesota Medical School to examine ways to remove barriers that exist in allowing medical students to have more meaningful experiences. Throughout this work, we received feedback highlighting the many challenges to both finding and retaining clinical preceptors. Some of the themes that emerged were that physicians were concerned with not having sufficient time available to teach. The second, that employers need to support their physicians as they take on the role of teacher for our next generation of physicians. And finally, that incentives are of value to physicians. As I work personally to address Minnesota's primary care physician workforce shortages, I experience many of the same challenges to finding and retaining preceptors. On my campus, we frequently discuss how we can reward and acknowledge the work of these physicians who essentially volunteer. And one way is we provide them with a free subscription to an online journal called Teaching Physician, through which they can earn free continuing medical education credits. I'm happy to report to you that our rural medical scholars preceptors collectively across the state recently won the 2020-2021 Rural Health Team Award as a group, recognizing their incredible volunteerism and the important role they play in role modeling, as Senator Klassen mentioned earlier. Most physicians who serve as preceptors for our future healthcare workforce do this without compensation. They do it because they know the importance of the work. However, with greater and greater pressure on reducing healthcare costs, there is greater pressure to increase production in our fee-for-service healthcare reimbursement model. That is resulting in employers not seeing the value in and not providing the time for precepting. Providing a tax credit is one small way to reward those who continue to serve this important role. This alone will not solve our healthcare worker shortage, but it will help me and my colleagues to recruit physicians and others on the healthcare team to serve as preceptors, ensuring that we have a well-trained health profession workforce into the future. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 3563. I am happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Onello. There may be questions. We'll wait until we hear from our second testifier as well. And that would be Megan McCoy. Megan, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Megan McCoy. I'm a physician assistant and the director of advanced practice providers at Hennepin Healthcare System, the state's largest safety net healthcare organization. We care for patients from across the state through our level one adult and pediatric trauma center, acute care hospital, and primary care clinics. The employed medical staff of Hennepin Healthcare includes a multi-specialty team of approximately 527 physicians and 345 advanced practice providers. Advanced practice providers comprise of physician assistants, nurse practitioners, certified nurse midwives, nurse anesthetists, and more. These providers, in addition to delivering care within the hospital and clinic system, train our future workforce. Currently, about 660 resident physicians, medical students, and advanced practice provider students train at Hennepin Healthcare each year. In fact, over half of all physicians currently practicing in Minnesota have received some part of their training at Hennepin Healthcare, and we are the primary teaching affiliate of more than 60 Minnesota schools. Hennepin Healthcare prides itself as an academic institution and encourages all employees to participate in teaching. Providers who agree to become preceptors are responsible for providing supervision during clinical practice and helping students apply what they've learned in school to patient situations. Preceptors set expectations, provide effective feedback, and supply appropriate opportunities to meet their learning objectives. Most importantly, preceptors guide students on how to deliver safe and high-quality patient care. The preceptor-student model is followed by educational institutions across the world. Due to the increased demand on healthcare workers to see more patients, and with the additional work that having a student can impose, along with increasing burnout in the healthcare profession, it is not surprising that the number of preceptors volunteering for this role has declined significantly. This deficit in those willing to teach impacts our ability to contribute to the education of future healthcare providers in the state. It decreases Minnesota schools' ability to accept students into their programs and ultimately decreases the overall quantity of healthcare providers available. Most importantly, it has negative effects on patient care as students often serve as liaisons between patients and providers and offer a level of care that is essential to quality outcomes. This tax credit is one tool we can use to incentivize providers to take on this additional and critical work in health systems. We rely on preceptors to support students in their learning, in particular, a safety net health system like Hennepin Healthcare. This bill would only apply to preceptors who provide 12 weeks or 480 hours as a preceptor for a student or medical resident during the tax year and who receive no additional compensation for doing so. We must find ways to reward those willing to go above and beyond to train the next generation. Thank you for hearing my testimony today, and thank you, Senator Clausen and the bill authors for supporting this important proposal.
Thank you very much. Members, any comments or questions? Thank you for the presentation. Certainly, having highly trained physicians and medical professionals every time we enter a medical arena is incredibly important. I think this bill will help. Thank you, Senator Clausen. Final comments.
Madam Chair and committee, thanks so much for hearing this bill this morning. I think the testifiers really did a nice job of outlining their situation and what's happening in Minnesota. Again, I think this would be a possible help to the bottleneck that we're currently having with some of our students who have completed their required coursework and are just waiting for that clinical experience out in the field under the mentorship of a preceptor. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Clausen. The bill will be laid over.
Thank you.
Senator Coleman.
All right, Senator Nelson moves Senate File 3879, and I understand you have an amendment, Senator?
Yes, the A1 amendment.
All right, Senator Nelson moves to adopt the A1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, the amendment is adopted. Senator Nelson, I believe you have an oral amendment to the A1 amendment.
Oh, yes. The oral amendment, is on line 1.5. We need to delete the words person or. So delete person or on line 1.5.
Sure. Ms. Pollack, did you want to speak to the amendment, oral amendment to the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair and members, The A1 amendment is purely technical, but the deletion of person or on 1.15 is just to avoid any confusion with the use of the term person, because it can have different legal meanings depending on the context. So by just using the word entity, that would be encompassing of any business entity or other taxpaying entity.
Okay. Any questions, members? All right, all in favor of adopting the oral amendment to the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 All right, opposed? The oral amendment is adopted. Senator Nelson, I think your bill is in the shape you'd like now to your bill.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Members, Senate File 3579 is the Minnesota New Markets Development Act. And the proposed excuse me, the biggest change, oh, I'm just talking about the amendment here. Let me just take a look here. All right, yes. We've adopted the amendment, technical in nature. The bill itself is a state-level program that builds on the successful federal New Markets Tax Credit. You might have heard of that, the New Markets Tax Credit Program. Highly successful in a number of other states. And we would like Minnesota to be able to pair our state funds with federal funds to provide private capital to support the growth of businesses in underserved communities in all corners of the state. The bill creates the New Market Tax Credit. It's for investors who make qualified equity investments in qualified community development entities. The credit would be related to the Federal New Markets Credit Program, which is administered by the U.S. Treasury Department's Community Development Fund, financial institutions, or as we call them, CDFIs. And the community development entities are defined in federal law as financial institutions that provide capital investments to low-income communities and that have been certified by the CDFI fund. As you can see, this bill is very much modeled off of those federal tax credits for new markets. The goal, again, is to get needed investment into communities of low income so that we can actually encourage and see the development of new jobs in those communities. I have a testifier with us today, and that is
Alex.
Oh, Alex, yes, I didn't see you on my list here. All right, Alex Stefanik is here to testify.
Thank you, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Perfect, thank you so much, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Alex Stefanik. I work for a company called Advantage Capital. We are one of about 300 community development entities, or CDEs, across the country that invest in low-income and underserved communities under the New Markets Tax Credit Program. New Markets is one of the most successful federal economic development programs of the last two decades because it pairs the public sector and the private sector, brings them together to ensure that communities, particularly low-income and underserved communities, are receiving the investment that their metropolitan counterparts traditionally do through venture capital and banking. So, in 2000, that bill was passed initially, and it's been renewed by every single administration since. And as part of that, there have been $66 billion that have been brought to underserved communities across the country. Now, unlike other federal programs where they allocate the funds based on the state population, this program, the CDFI fund, will create a competitive allocation process. So these CDEs, all 300 of them across the country, are competing every single year to be one of the 50 to 100 that receive a share of that $5 billion annually that is being that they will be able to put out in the states. So of that, the difficult part was some states were getting significantly more and some states were getting significantly less. So in about 2007, states started passing state-level New Markets Tax Credit programs. And with that, the goal was bring these funds that were going to the states that were getting significantly more and bring them to the states that were getting, that wanted to be taking more better advantage of this program. And so one of those states, there's been 14 that have passed it in the past since 2007. Of those 14 states, there have been 33 either passages or renewals of New Markets programs at the state level. And one state nearby that has passed it recently is Nebraska. They passed it in 2012. Prior to that, they were near the very bottom of federal New Markets funds that they were receiving per capita. And after they passed the program in 2012 and the years that followed, they shot up to number two in the country for receiving these federal funds. And what that really looks like, I mean, it's notable, but what it really looks like for the businesses that are receiving this funding are, I'll call on a call center in North Omaha called North End Teleservices. The entrepreneur had wanted to buy back full ownership of the business. She wanted to be able to expand her operations, and she couldn't find financing to be able to make it happen. So we were able to help her through the New Markets Tax Credit Program, get the financing she needed, and she's taken her 70-person business and has been able to grow it to over 250 employees and is one of the largest minority and women-owned businesses in the state. And those are all jobs that are being created in an area where quality jobs really make a difference in the lives of their residents. So that's really what we're talking about here in Minnesota. It's a state-level take on a successful federal program that's been proven in other states. And the goal is to be able to get those businesses that need financing after they've been able to maybe take advantage of an angel tax credit, maybe work with a local economic development corp that's been able to help them get their business off the ground. And then now they're looking for the next level of financing to be able to grow their business here in Minnesota. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Any questions, members? Seeing none, I think you have a remote testifier, Senator Nelson.
Yes. Henry Jimenez.
Jimenez. Don't see him.
Yep.
Oh, there you are.
Thank you.
All right. Welcome, Henry. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Henry Jimenez. I'm the Executive Director of the Latino Economic Development Center. I'm here in support of Senate File 3879, the Minnesota New Markets Development Act. LADC is a community development financial institution that provides startup coaching, management training, technical assistance, and microlending to Latino entrepreneurs across the state, with 40% of our capital going to Greater Minnesota. LADC provides as much of the resources as possible to entrepreneurs to get their business started, including providing them with as much access to micro-lending financing necessary to start a business. However, even CDFIs like LADC have limited resources and need to compete at a state and national level for available funds, just as Alex mentioned. This bill provides the next level of financing that entrepreneurs need when trying to grow their business. Through this program and in partnership with Minnesota-based investors, we would be able to help more small businesses that are growing and need access to growth capital in the $1 to $5 million range, connect with community development entities investing under the New Market Program to get them access to capital. Several of our clients who you may be acquainted with could benefit from this, such as Los Ocampos or La Loma Tamales in the Twin Cities, Chavez Event Center LLC in Long Prairie, Minnesota, or the Compadres LLC in Rochester, as Senator Nelson is acquainted with, as they seek to expand into their third location. Access to capital is what's slowing growth for these businesses. The $200 million that this program would provide to support small businesses in the areas that need access to capital would be significant benefits for small businesses to grow in our state. The Minnesota New Market Development Act is a great investment in Minnesota small businesses and helps Minnesota-based CDEs be more competitive and attracting more federal funds into our state. I recommend this committee support this bill. Thank you for your time and thank you for your leadership, Senator Nelson.
Thank you very much. And I believe you have one other testifier, Senator Nelson?
Yes, Mary Stoy, Sunrise Springs.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senators. Thank you for having me. My name is Mary Stoik. I'm the Director of Tax Credit Lending for Sunrise Banks here in Minnesota. And I appreciate the opportunity to express our support for this bill. I'd like to start by telling you a story. It begins with two brothers who started a business as teenagers, making furniture out of their dad's garage in the early 1980s. These brothers steadily grew their business and today run a $25 million successful manufacturing company that specializes in acoustic ceiling and wall panels. Needless to say, they've outgrown the family garage. In late 2019, Sunrise was able to leverage the Federal New Market Tax Credits program and assist this locally owned family business in acquiring a second building adjacent to their first location and continue their rapid expansion. New Markets allowed this business to remain in its current location, right here in West St. Paul, and avoid the costly disruption of moving. It also ensured they would keep and add to over 200 high-paying jobs in a census tract whose median income is less than 60% of the state's average. Also notably, 95% of those jobs are accessible to individuals with no more than a high school diploma. And in fact, the company actively seeks to hire as much as possible from the local community and train its employees for internal advancement. New Markets is part of what made this story possible and kept skilled, well-paying jobs in an economically distressed neighborhood. Sunrise has participated in the federal New Markets program since 2008, and we've been fortunate enough to receive 6 allocation awards to date, totaling over $300 million. We have been able to leverage this allocation to provide over $250 million of capital in 60 different projects and counting. These projects alone have created or retained over 7,000 jobs just in our local Twin Cities area. The impact of this tax credit tool is truly tremendous, and the need for economic investment in struggling communities across our state cannot be underestimated. The benefits of this program go to census tracts where we see high poverty rates, lower than average median income rates, and high unemployment. It also provides resources and incentive for renovation and rehabilitation of damaged or abandoned buildings, environmental remediation, rent accessibility for small businesses, access to health care in medically underserved communities, and access to healthy food in food deserts. What does this practically mean for our businesses and nonprofits in our community? It means they have access to affordable financing. It means they receive 7 years of below market fixed interest rates, interest only payments, no origination fees, higher loan to value ratios, and they also get approximately 20 to 25% of their total debt available for a forgiveness option at the end of the tax credit term. These are real benefits that make a lot of projects that otherwise wouldn't be able to happen become possible. I'll close with another quick story. New Markets can be leveraged to help businesses grow and provide jobs. It can also help nonprofit organizations expand services. In 2018, Sunrise was able to leverage New Markets to help Crescent Cove build the first children's hospice home in the state of Minnesota, and just the third in the entire United States. Crescent Cove, located in Brooklyn Center, is an amazing place that provides respite and hospice care to over 80 kids in 2021, from around the state. Over 70% of these services went to low-income families. Crescent Cove has also brought 17 high-paying skilled jobs to a census tract with nearly 30% poverty rate and AMI of only 45%. I urge you to expand access to this program within the state of Minnesota with the proposed Senate file number 3879, and appreciate your time today. I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I believe Senator Dietzig, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I have just some general questions, and then I have on page 3.28, do we need to get rid of that person or? On line 3.28.
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzig, yes, I believe so.
So I'll move an oral amendment to get rid of person or on line 3.28.
That's all right with you. Okay, Senator Dietzig moves an oral amendment. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, the oral amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you for clarifying that and for catching that. That was to be part of the original oral amendment. Before, one of the things I neglected to do is perhaps it would be save us some time if we had Ms. Pollack do a general bill walkthrough. It is, as I said, it's modeled after the federal tax credits. And I think hopefully there we'll just get all of your questions answered in a sequential order. And so, Madam Chair, if we could have Ms. Pollack walk through the bill, again, modeled after the federal credits. But hopefully those questions will be answered. But if you see any other oversights, such as carrying that First Amendment language over, we do want to hear that for sure. And I also want to thank Senator Rest for co-sponsoring as well. But let's get to the bill walkthrough, Madam Chair.
Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I'll do kind of a very high-level walkthrough of the bill, and I worked with Mr. Stepanek in drafting the bill, so I may need his help on if there are specific questions. Correct. The credit kind of starts with an entity being certified under the federal CDFI fund. at the point that they are, after the time that they are certified at the federal level, they could be eligible to apply for a state new markets tax credit. $100 million is allocated for Greater Minnesota, and $100 million in credits is allocated to the metro area, which are defined in the bill. By tying in the federal qualification criteria, there's a little bit more of an easier application process as far as the proving qualifications and then administration of the program. However, the application would have to be deemed complete by the Department of by DEED, and if upon review the application is not complete, the applicant would have 15 days to cure it, after which time they would be designated as having qualified for the credit. If it's not complete, then they would have to begin the application process again. The credit is allocated or claimed over a 7-year period. So for the first 2 years, the credit is zero. For the following 5 years, it's 10% of the amount of the qualified equity investment each year, so for a total of 50% of the investment. There are disqualifications or clawbacks from the credit, so including if an entity withdraws its investment within that period of time, no longer becomes certified or becomes disqualified at the federal level. Madam Chair and members, I think that's kind of an overview of how the credit works and is structured. If there are other questions, I may be able to answer them, or Mr. Stepanek.
Thank you. Senator Dietzick, did you have any questions after that walkthrough?
Thank you. I'm still, thinking about that.
Sure.
Thank you.
Any other questions, members, right now? Seeing none. Senator Nelson, any closing comments?
Members, again, this is one of the things that we know is so important, which is economic development, and it needs to, sometimes economic development occurs in communities that are already seeing jobs and job growth, and we appreciate that. But it's very important, if we're really serious about talking about equity in this state, and if we're really talking about empowering all Minnesotans, it's critical that we get some of these early investments, these economic opportunities in some of our most distressed economically parts of the state. I believe your packet has a map that shows what those identified census tracts are that would be eligible. And again, this is all based upon the federal new market tax credit. So those census tracts are identified. The eligibility of what those qualified development entities are also qualified at the federal level. And this bill just simply allows Minnesota to build upon that and maximize the value of that federal new markets tax credit, just as many other states have done as well. And as you have seen, just using the federal new markets tax credit that is available in Minnesota, by adding our Minnesota new market tax credit to that, we can double that impact. We can extend that impact. We can, just as other states have as well. And so I would just ask that we will lay this over. I do want to note before we do, there are letters of support from the Minnesota Bankers Association. And I think there's another letter of support in here, too. So we want to thank that good support. I will lay this over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. With that, Senate File 3879 is laid over as amended.
Senator Weber, would you like to move your bill, Senate File 3401?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Weber. To your bill, excess premium credit creation for health insurers.
Thank you very much. As we all know, Madam Chair and members, when the Affordable Care Act was established, they provided for a federal health insurance marketplace, but gave states the right to create their own, which Minnesota did, and that is now known as MinSure. One of the elements of MinSure is that rates for insurance premiums are determined, obviously, through by age and area. And many of our rural areas have received the disproportionately higher rates as opposed to the metro area. Southeast and Southwest Minnesota are two areas that have had significantly higher rates through this particular program. What this bill does is that it offers a non-refundable credit to those who purchase either gold or silver health insurance plan through MinSure that exceed the 120% statewide average premium for those metal level purchased plans for that year. The premiums, of course, vary from year to year. Minnesota has undertaken steps in the private insurance market through reinsurance in order to write some of the premium costs down. But those who purchase this through MinSure, certainly at this point in our rural areas, still have to pay a much higher rate. So the basics of the proposed credit, that it would equal 100% of the excess premium for a silver plan and 75% for a gold plan. And the maximum credit allowed is $10,000. It also would start to go up to incomes of $150,000. I have had families tell me that their health insurance premium costs are in the $30,000 plus range for their health insurance. And I don't care what your income is at that point, that takes a major bite out of a family's budget. This bill, I want to give proper credit, was actually developed by Representative Haley from Red Wing area. And I have agreed to carry it in the Senate because I believe it addresses an issue that is an inequity that is there with the Affordable Care Act for our ratepayers in greater Minnesota. And there is, I would draw your attention to the revenue notes. I don't intend to go through them. The department has given an analysis detail. From reading that, you will find that they've had to make various assumptions. There are certain elements that just aren't quite known. I'm not going to speak for the department. They are here, and if you have questions for them, I would encourage you to ask them. With that, Madam Chair, I would just turn. Brian Fries is online to testify, and I would turn the testifier's table over to him at this point.
Thank you,
Mr. Fries,
Madam
Chair. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Morning. Thank you all for your time today. My name is Brian Fries. And along with my wife, Sarah, we are raising three children in Wabasha, small town in southeast Minnesota. In 2021, we applied but did not qualify for the MinSure tax credits, and our premiums had climbed to over $26,000 a year. Through MinSure, we were able to pay $20,000 per year in premiums. Not the Cadillac of insurance, but better than nothing. Our family deductible was around $14,000 a year. If you add that to our premiums, our total out-of-pocket could reach $34,000 a year, and that's really when the insurance kicked in.
Our 2022 plan, again obtained through MinSure, is about $24,000 per year, and with a family deductible that's over $14,000. That puts our total annual cost of health insurance at nearly $38,000 per year. That's roughly 40% of our gross income. This is catastrophic insurance coverage with Cadillac pricing. It does not cover vision, it's not covered dental, it doesn't really cover us if we're outside of the state of Minnesota either. Even with health insurance, we could be one major illness away from financial devastation. This is not one particular health insurer, it's all of the health insurance companies. We live in rural Minnesota, so our health insurance options are more limited than people who live in the metro. If we all had affordable health insurance, maybe we could save money for our children's college, or for our retirement. We can't all work for the government or a huge corporation that offers affordable health insurance. The insurance costs really should be the same for everyone, regardless of their zip code. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimony. Senator Weber, let's see. We'll go to questions after all of your testifiers. Do you have any other testifiers?
Ann Buck is listed from Goodhue. I had checked earlier. I didn't see her online.
Ms. Buck, are you online? We don't have that connection, Senator Weber, but she's welcome to send us her testimony, and we'll be glad to include that with the record. So before we go to Senator Weber for any further closing comments, I just want to see if there's any questions. Senator Klein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Weber. I really like the idea of the bill. I actually have a question for you, but first for your testifiers. The Freeze family, and thank you so much for coming in online and testifying with us today. I just want to know a little bit more about your business. What do you do for a living, and how did you end up in this situation where your premiums, as you said, are 40% of your income? Are you a small business owner, or tell me a little bit more about yourself?
Mr. Freeze.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I am a small business owner, and my wife is a veterinarian. So we're both...
Oh, Mr. Freeze, we lost your audio. Could you repeat that, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
I am self-employed. I own my own business, and my wife is a veterinarian. And so, we're not able to get in any of the big group pools we're just on the free market for health insurance.
Yep.
Senator Klein.
Yeah, so thank you very much for the work you're doing and for your wife for being a veterinarian. And I guess the only reason for the question is, I don't think this is exclusively a rural issue, actually. I think there are families like the Freezes in District 52 and all across Minnesota, so I'm grateful for the initiative. And then I had a question either for the author or for the department or council. Are these tax credits only available to people who purchase through the exchange, or are they available outside of that?
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Klein. Basically, the bill outlines talks about excess premium, and for those who do not qualify for any type of premium tax credit, and basically it refers to the coverages that are available through the MnSure program. Yeah.
Senator Klein, any further comments? Members, any further comments? Well, Senator Weber, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very honest about it. I'm not sure whether this proposal is ready for prime time, as we like to say around here, or not. But I think what it does is that it highlights an issue and an inequity that exists within the healthcare system. So oftentimes we think that if government has put it forth that there aren't any problems involved with it, that there aren't any inequities involved with it, and quite frankly, that's simply not true. I think it's really important to remember. And sometimes people say, well, the rural areas, their access to healthcare is so limited. Yes, it is. However, my existing Senate district covers roughly 100 miles east to west. The new Senate district will be 130-some miles east to west. Almost everyone within that, than my Senate district, current or new, within an hour and a half, will have availability with a good ambulance service to emergency care and many times much less time than that. And some say, well, we just need to have more people involved in the Medicare insurance program. And let's never forget that government insurance manages to stay solvent by reducing the payments to the providers. And well over half of the patients in my provider's systems either today qualify for Medicare and or Medicaid. And the reduced rate of reimbursement, if we were to increase that, quite frankly, would force some of them out of business. And so, that is not an option, a viable option, in order to ensure that healthcare remains available. I think that this provides some opportunities for our people who are really getting hit with these high premiums. And with that, Madam Chair, I would thank you for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Senator Weber. Senate File 3401 is laid over. Senator Rust has Senate File 3572, and I believe there is an A1 amendment. This is a bill regarding income measure used by education and credit modification. Used by the education credit modification. Senator Rest, would you like to move your bill?
I'm going to comment on it first.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Senator Rest.
This Senate file does address the education credit that's available for families with regard to certain expenses for their children's education. The A1 amendment is not new language, is what I wanted to point out. If you look at the second page of the bill, at the provision that is number 16, there's a paragraph of language there, and the bill eliminates the definition of household income, but we do need to retain the difference in taxable year. And so what the A1 amendment does, it's not adding new language, it's putting language back in that is necessary. So with that, I would move the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Senator Rest. This is an author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Senator Rest, your bill is amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as we know, with the TCJA, we went from using federal taxable income to adjusted gross income to determine tax liability for Minnesota individual taxpayers. What this bill does is make that same change, not taxable income, but make that same change away from household income, which includes all non-taxable income, and starts instead with adjusted gross income. It really amounts to a simplification for the taxpayer. No other changes are in it, and it is relatively inexpensive. If you look at the revenue estimate, it is what? It is less than $1 million in the first year, and a little bit less than that in the succeeding years. I would point out, so it's a very simple, mechanically simple provision to go from household income, and if you're interested in what the definition of household income is, that is provided on that 1R page that is being deleted in this bill. And The governor, I might point out, also has a proposal that moves toward adjusted gross income as the beginning for a calculation for the education credit. This bill makes no other changes. It doesn't change the amount of the credit. It doesn't shift any of the income thresholds at all, which I think also leads to the rather modest, for in this day and age, at least this session, modest revenue estimate. The governor's proposal, just to put that out on the table, it increases that threshold for when the phase out begins to $70,000 from the current $33,000. And it adjusts it, that threshold, annually for inflation. And I would suggest that, I don't have an amendment ready right now, but I would suggest that if we want to pursue an improvement in this education credit, if we adopted adjusted gross income, but then allowed it to, the threshold to rise according to inflation, I think that would be very very helpful. And we know that there are other provisions in our tax law that, like our actual taxable income, to which the rates are applied, that they are indeed adjusted for inflation. So this bill makes one big change, and that is definition of income, moves from household income, which includes all non-taxable income. There's a long list, and shifts it to adjusted gross income, but makes no other changes. So that's the bill, and do have one testifier.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Matt Norris, and I'm the Policy Director and Director of Minnesota After School Advance at Youth Prize. We strongly support the simple but important change proposed by Senate File 3572, and thank Senator Rest for bringing it forward along with Senators Klein and Dietzick. This tax credit helps families pay for after-school activities, computers, school supplies, and musical instruments. I'm sure you've all heard the personal stories from your own districts of the impact that the pandemic has had on Minnesota students. Many of them are a year or more behind in school, and computers are now a ubiquitous part of the learning experience. This means that after-school programs like tutoring and access to computers are not just luxuries anymore, they're necessities. That's why we've seen a 3,400% increase in demand over the past 2 years for our Minnesota After School Advance program, which helps families use this tax credit. We've served families from over 200 Minnesota cities during that time and leveraged this tax credit to pay for over 18,000 hours of tutoring just last year alone. This tax credit is one of the best tools the state has for getting students caught up academically and shifting to using federal adjusted gross income to calculate eligibility rather than the more complex household income definition would make it easier for families to get the assistance their students need. The income limit for the maximum credit, as Senator Rest mentioned, is $33,500 for that maximum credit. From our experience, this means the typical taxpayer using this credit is often a single parent juggling multiple jobs and primarily focused on just a daily struggle to meet their family's basic needs. They often have limited formal education and may not speak English as a first language or at all. They often have little familiarity with taxes and the tax filing system, and they're reliant on others to guide them through the process. Combine those factors together, and navigating the current household income definition is a steep barrier to a parent simply looking to get their student some tutoring or a computer. For example, just one of the items included in this definition is, and I quote, the amount of a passive activity loss that is not disallowed as a result of Section 469, paragraph I or M of the Internal Revenue Code, and the amount of passive activity loss carryover allowed under Section 469B of the Internal Revenue Code, end quote. With all due respect, I'm guessing many of you, even as members of the Tax Committee, are sitting here wondering whether you would have anything to report under that item. I know I am, even with a law degree. Now imagine that taxpayer I previously described trying to navigate that same definition. Other elements of the definition lack any logical consistency. For instance, MFIT payments count toward the income limit, but SNAP benefits do not. The result is a daunting maze that we do our best to help families navigate. We currently employ 3 part-time navigators just to help families with this process, and we're in the process of hiring a 4th. This is in addition to a network of community-based organizations around the state that we rely on. In contrast, federal adjusted gross income is a single number that we can point families to on their annual tax return. Over time, the state has been gradually phasing out this household income definition for these types of tax credits. Just a few years ago, the legislature shifted the dependent care credit from household income to AGI, and it's time we make the same change for this tax credit as well. Before I close, I'd like to briefly note that we still believe we also need to update the income limit for this tax credit. It hasn't been changed in 25 years, and we'd like to thank the strong bipartisan group of senators, including Senators Eichhorn, Rest, Nelson, Chamberlain, Klein, and Dietzick, who have all authored or co-authored legislation to that end. We urge you to leverage this bipartisan support, along with support from the House and the Governor's Office, to make this the year we finally get that income limit updated. However, today's bill is another important step forward to making this tax credit more fair and accessible for the Minnesota taxpayers that it's intended to serve. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norris. Thank you for your work. Members, any questions or comments? I do thank Youth Prize and all of our, everyone who's so focused on our kids, particularly, and their education. We know education is the great equalizer. And many of us, I think all of us in Minnesota, are gravely concerned about the last 2 years going on. It's not over yet, perhaps, but the last 2 years where our kids have not had the education that they need, and they've not been able to see their teachers. And we are thankful to live in a time of great technological advancement that allows for things like Zoom, things like that, online education, things like Khan Academy. We're really appreciative of those things. We do want to make sure that all parents have access to all the tools today. But knowing that teachers in the classrooms are most important, I would say it's very concerning for the many, many, many kids who have not had that opportunity much in the last 2 years, and then not even today in Minneapolis. It's just very, very frustrating. We know that more and more parents are looking, and rightfully so. How can they make sure that their kids are great readers and that their kids get the education that they need? So, Senator Rest, I appreciate you bringing the bill. We'll turn it over to you for final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to be flippant, but people that receive a lot of passive income aren't going to qualify for this credit to start with. So in terms of their adjusted gross income. But I do think that it's worth a look in any number of instances where we base a benefit on household income, which includes all of that non-taxable income. And that includes Social Security, too. There can be some parents who receive SSI for a disability, but still want to provide for their children, even though they're not receiving Social Security because of their age eligibility. So I do think this is time to make this change for this credit, and that we should continue to look at it for other credits as well, and particularly with regard, qu- quite frankly, to our property tax refunds. But this is a start for this credit. Again, I think in addition, at least tying the threshold of the income, if we don't raise it to the level at which the governor has it at 70,000, that we seriously consider indexing it to inflation. But thank you very much for hearing the bill, Madam Chair and colleagues.
Thank you, Senator Rust. Senate File 3572 is laid over as amended. Members, thank you so much for the attention today. We see a lot of good bills in this committee that can really benefit Minnesotans from corner to corner all across this state. Today is this meeting is adjourned. Our next hearing is March 22nd.